Thank you for listening to Food End, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Amanda Balaguer. This episode is being recorded during Native American Heritage Month, which initially began around 1915. However, it didn't officially become recognized for the month of November until 1990. Now, 30 years later, there is a growing revival of cultural practices based in seasonal nutrition, reciprocal relationships, and the stewardship of land and water. We have the honor to hear stories from an Indigenous changemaker who is revitalizing their ancestral traditions and food ways. Which leads me to welcome today's guest, Elena Terry. She's the coordinator of the Food and Culinary Program for the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance, or NAFSA, based in Minnesota. As a chef and mentor, Elena proudly serves Native cuisine and teaches food sovereignty to revive Native foods and to show people how beautiful these foods are. Thank you for joining us, Elena.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been mentored by amazing Native chefs, including Sean Sherman and Loretta Barrett Odin. As founder and executive chef of Wild Berries, you are using your catering business to mentor others about Native foods, people who taught and inspired you in the kitchen growing up, and the kinds of meals you create or recreate to connect with your ancestral roots. What does it mean to be a Native farmer or chef in this globalized and politicized gastronomy?
Well, it's pretty significant right now, especially when it comes to our ancestral foods and really nourishing our communities again. If you're a chef, you have to be able to source what ingredients you need to do or where you need to get those from directly from a farmer. We don't have the luxury as Indigenous chefs to be able to go to the grocery store and buy what we need all the time. We have to anticipate that we're going to need that the following year and either go forage it or grow it or have it grown for us. Preserving it, you gain a mindfulness about consumption and continuing that knowledge for the next generation is crucial. So I think that right now with the food systems the way they are, I don't like to say food desert. I kind of had a conversation with one of my friends, Linda Black Elk, a couple months ago, and she used a term that she had heard, and instead of saying food desert, because deserts are actually really plentiful, that it's a food junkyard. And when you think about what is necessary for us really just to maintain mental health, you know, a connection to something other than your immediate household, when you become responsible for the land in a lot of different ways, mindful farming and sustainable practicing, I think that those intentions have been lost along the way with the convenience of grocery stores. And it's definitely a time where people are listening, and I love talking about it and doing it and showing. So with Wild Berries, that connection and responsibility to our food systems just naturally became evolved into this mentorship program with my community. And it really was based on the idea of, all of us suffer a disconnect at some point with our community, that it's a beautiful way to bring people back, myself included, is to share a meal, to prepare a meal, and to say, like, not only is this a wonderful meal that I took all day preparing for you, but I also went and, you know, the wild rice is from my good friend, and the corn was grown from this other friend, and I went and got these mushrooms. And, you know, there's a lot more that goes into a meal like that than going to the grocery store and getting a can off the shelf, which we all have to do sometimes, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's when you take the time to have those other meals, so much more grows out of it.
So speaking of the products and the foods that you're using, what are some of the challenges that Native farmers and producers are encountering with the effects of climate change?
When you think of climate change, even this year significantly, there's always going to be environmental factors that are unforeseen when it comes to agriculture, say squash bugs or something. But when you have seeds that are ancestral and you have a limited amount of those seeds, it is very significant that you're mindful of those environmental factors. So something like climate change, where you have a drought this year and heavy rains last year, it greatly affects your ability to know that your crop will be consistent. And so there's a lot of unpredictable factors, and unfortunately climate change is something that doesn't have to be as severe as it is or affect everybody's food system, not just Indigenous chefs at this time. If we all make small changes, we can do that. And I think some of those changes come from leading by example.
In your opinion, or what are your thoughts on what future struggles Native farmers might face?
I think one of the first struggles is that hopefully we'll still have Native farmers. You know, I mean, I've been talking with some of our youth, and we just did a tour, the honoring the farmers, foragers, growers, and producers, just to highlight the work that's being done so that people can really see where their food comes from, you know, and then these beautiful ingredients that people put a lot of intention into. But there's this X factor. And what do you do in any situation, not just in agriculture, but when this X factor can significantly affect whether or not you're going to be economically stable in any given year, and you have no idea, you just have to kind of risk it. And so what can we do to support them so that they can continue that work and not have to worry about whether or not their bills will be paid if something like a bug comes and takes a crop? You know, so we're actually working in the Great Lakes region here on setting up some sort of system where we could produce a product with trade and have different suppliers provide one ingredient to that product, but then we would be able to have a fund for, you know, incidentals and really be able to support the future and say, not only is agriculture cool and learning about your food systems and continuing to grow these insane ingredients that have been around for centuries, but we want to make sure that you can do that and not worry about how you're going to pay your bills or if it you will ever not be in debt for a farm. You know, like, how can we make the environment more conducive for success? So what do we have to do, you know, crucially have to do right now today to ensure that those food systems, that knowledge will be there for the future? And part of that is making sure that the future has an environment that they can continue that work in.
Thank you for listening to the Food and Podcast. I'm Professor Ellen Messer, and I urge you to visit our blog at sites.bu.edu/gastronomy, because there you will find select readings and books recommended by myself and other gastronomy faculty at Boston University that we recommend you take a look at because they're extremely interesting. For example, I recommend reading Indigenous Food Systems, Concepts, Cases, and Conversations, edited by Priscilla Setti and Shailesh Sukla from Canadian Scholars Press 2020. They relate very, very well also to a film, a documentary that was recently produced here in the US entitled Gather, which is a really soul-stirring presentation about relationships between local Indigenous populations and their food resources. These really deep and very diverse case studies beautifully integrate to tell the story of survival. We're still here, and Indigenous efforts to educate the younger generation to preserve and conserve their food and nutrition resources. And they continue to illustrate these kinds of concepts that are pointed out in Indigenous food systems with additional cases and conversations in the US.
So Native cuisine and Indigenous foodways are taking center stage in media, getting more attention lately. For example, we have the Food Network's Chopped featuring Chef Crystal Wapepa and the documentary film Gather, which was released this past June to rave reviews from critics. In your view, how have Native producers, chefs, and cuisine become more visible?
I have to say that when, you know, we eat Indigenous food several times a week, but we started 5 years ago, you know, my entire life, we only ate it at ceremonies, and it wasn't as readily accessible as it is now, even as opposed to 10 years ago. But I think being outside and connecting, you know, on so many levels, if you have the hunters, you have the foragers, you have the cultivators, and it's just this wonderful community that people have been thriving off of. And for NAFSA, one of the things that I had insisted on when I went on, I came on board, and I think it was a universal feeling, was that, you know, none of this work can be ego driven. It never can be. And if you have a true mentorship program, or you really are concerned about progress, nothing can be ego driven. It has to be about what I can do to let the ones behind me, get them at where I'm at, and then do everything I can to push them forward, or we will always be where I'm at. You know, we will never get ahead. And I think that having some amazing mentors in my life, and having people putting so many messages that are unique to themselves, ended up making this wonderful, strong front of relatability, where people, if you don't relate to me, you'll relate to Crystal or to Sean or to Loretta. And all of us have, you know, this wonderful message of solidarity when it comes to our Indigenous foods, but we all have a little bit different way that we go about that and our specialties. And I think that having so many people come together and say that we are standing in solidarity, and it isn't about me, it's about them, you know, the next generation and the generation after that, that we're able to make so much progress because it isn't just one of us.
So speaking of the next generation, how do you think this increased visibility and availability impacts younger generations that you're depending upon to carry on these roles? Have you noticed, for example, increased interest, more knowledge sharing within the community and even outside of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So with our garden here in Wild Berries, we actually started the Garden Berries this year, which was a group of youth that just came over that were interested in seeing us work. And they, you know, started bringing buckets and moving rocks and then coming over to weed or to help tie up tomato plants, and seeing them have interest, you know, in that, and being outside rather than inside with a video game in the summer or something, you know, and helping them get grounded that way, it was beautiful. And then, so to go off from that initial work at the garden, I went and harvested with them and let them take the fruit of their harvest home. And I know anybody that has a kid that gets to bring something home from, you know, that they had worked on, the sense of pride, like it was a bowl of cherry tomatoes that I was able to send home with all of them, but they, you know, were sending pictures, eating these tomatoes. And it was really the accomplishment, like I was able to do this because I cared for it. They have that sensical memory and it's in their blood now. And they will always know, you know, this is what it should taste like. Or I remember when I was young and I worked at the garden and Elena brought this, or, you know, any one of the other berries that helps. It's just really about building community and showing them that it is important. And the only way you can really do that is by living it. And when you do that, I think people naturally are attracted to participate. And when it is the young ones willing to learn that kind of behavior, then I'm always down to help support. So it has been a beautiful revolution here, you know, and when it comes to our food systems and the connections that have been made. Even the youth hunt that just recently happened, I saw so many young ones out. I was excited.
Tell me a little bit about the youth hunt, just so our listeners know.
So they have a special hunting here in the state of Wisconsin, where I'm at, for youth to go out and hunt. And it's before bow season, which is before gun season. So they kind of get the highest population to go with. And of course you have to take your hunter safety and stuff, but it was amazing. I saw, you know, it wasn't obviously just the kids going out. It was the kids with their dads or their uncles and grandpa or, you know, mom. And I remember being a child and having my uncles and my grandma go out hunting with them. That part never interested me, but I was waiting for them to bring back the hunt so that I could, you know, get it processed and get everything taken care of. So I think that, like I said, even with all of us and our missions, when it comes to food, it's relatable to everybody. It's a universal. So what part of that are you connected to? You know, and that's where you can, you know, it's naturally the way our communities worked.
You're listening to Food And, a podcast from the gastronomy program at Boston University Metropolitan College, with your host, food journalist, Amanda Belliger. Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events in food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
You were talking about how students and researchers can learn through and from the tradition of oral history.
There was a virtual Intertribal Food Summit in June, and I was lucky enough to be on this panel of people that I never have had a chance to sit and speak with collectively, have a conversation, and said, I've always been wanting to know from you, all of you specifically, tell me a time when you found something like an ingredient or the first time that you tasted something where you were like, wow, you know, and everybody has that, a memory like that, you know, a favorite food, or when you were like, I had no idea that this would taste like this, or, you know, and they all came up with these incredibly unique stories in connecting to these ingredients. And even that becomes oral tradition. You know, I remember when I was out hunting and I smelled sweetgrass in the winter, and I thought, why am I smelling this and looking for it, you know, and why was that there at that moment? And those are the stories that continue on in your interpretation of those stories. Mm-hmm. And so for somebody to be able to have those conversations with a knowledge keeper, somebody that's willing to share, or if they are researching some of those stories, which exist, you know, in different forms, it's really knowing that they're not just stories, that those stories came from something, whether or not it was an idea or an experience, that is a connection to somebody else. And so they're crucial. Everything that we did was orally, like all of our teachings, our language, none of it was ever written. So that knowledge has been able to be shared for generations. And speaking from experience, hearing some of those stories is incredible. So definitely if you're interested in it, do some of that research, because it's beautiful, even, you know, how some things fall from the sky in the stories, or, you know, just the way that there is so much intent and thought that goes behind each one of these plants or animals, and giving its life for you to nourish you and your family for an extended amount of time or something. And remembering those, I think, will help us preserve our food systems and our food traditions in a sustainable way for the future, and making sure that people understand that connection goes deeper than, you know, just providing this meal right now, that it is linked to when that ingredient first came to us.
So can you tell us more about the seed rematriation program at NAFSA?
The intention behind that really is that some seeds have traveled during removals, during whatever has happened, and how do we get those seeds home? A good example of that is us, Ho-Chunk Nation. My seed saver and I, we have always been corn stewards, and we've grown corn for centuries and have held these pure strains of white, blue, red corn, the Ho-Chunk people. And we knew we grew the Three Sisters. It's, you know, the perfect region to have those plants thrive. But we didn't have a squash. And 3 years ago, a Winnebago squash, which was formerly Ho-Chunk Nation, came to us. And it was rematriated by somebody who had grown it out. And we only started with 4 squash. And us as Ho-Chunks or Winnebagos, which is what we were known as before and where the squash got its name, we only got 2 of them. But over the past 2 years now, that has thrived, and we have enough seed to have it grown in 3 places instead of just 1 next year. So it's not a quick process, but so the seed for the squash was rematriated. And then we were saying, we only need to find the bean. And all of a sudden over the winter last year, a friend of mine from Appalachia in Kentucky mailed me a bean that is traceable. And we found it was so incredibly traceable that it moved with us. And the journey of the Ho-Chunk Nation being relocated to South Dakota, to Nebraska, that seed took those journeys, but then it went and ended up in Kentucky and took this 50-year slumber and was returned to us. So that's rematriation. He was able to bring it home. And now next year, we grew one of them. There were two separate Ho-Chunk beans that came home. And next year we'll grow both of them out. And so it's that seed has its own life, and that seed took its own journey, and it traveled with us, and it nourished us through those travels. You know, we were some of the tribes that we were moved six times as Ho-Chunk people, and to save those seeds, we would sew them into our clothes, or we would hide them. And we were, you know, back then, when you talk about these long journeys, the journey from Chamberlain, South Dakota to Wisconsin Dells was a long one. Mm-hmm. And that seed made that journey with our people, and that we knew how important it was. But at some point, it knew it had to go somewhere and stay safe and rest. And then it came home to us. So now we have the three sisters united, and, you know, we were able to get those together for my daughter, who is a farmer, who wants to be a farmer. I wanted her to be a chef, but she's a little bit more into cultivating plants. But now I'm able to say, you know, I was able to find these for you, and they're here because it's time that they came home. And so that's the kind of work that the Indigenous Seed Keepers Network does. But that's just my own personal story of a rematriated seed and how it came back.
Thank you for listening to Food And. You can learn more about our guests on our blog at sites.bu.edu/gastronomy. There you can register for our fall 2020 PIPPEN lecture series with food historian Zella Palmer, Recipes and Remembrances of Fair Dillard on November 20th. Registration is open to the public and free.
Moving on to a very different topic, but ultimately very timely. The Native communities across the country have been hit particularly hard by COVID-19. And I'm wondering, based on your own knowledge, what effect, if any, this has had on Native food systems?
Had a huge effect. Like, and again, not only on Native, but on universally on food systems. It did affect us significantly. And I can speak, you know, for BIPOC people or for rural people, you know, and in our community here, we are a non-reservation tribe, and we're throughout the state of Wisconsin. So we have trust lands, but we don't have one centralized reservation. You know, immediately and it was all part of the food systems with the USDA and trying to save agriculture and people that weren't able to even ship milk. You know, all of a sudden there was an abundance of these foods. That was good because immediately everybody was laid off, you know, and not able to provide the same way that they were used to. And being in that situation is, it's nothing new to us, you know, but it's a shift in what you're accustomed to in routine, really. And so immediately the USDA and the Ho-Chunk Nation, you know, we worked out a partnership and we started doing food distribution boxes weekly. So right now, you touched on it a little bit before, there's this glimmer of connection and interest in Indigenous foodways. And so I can say that as a chef, I've been working a lot more than I did when I'm in the kitchen, trying to be proactive and to say, we have to get product grown. You know, those plans need to be in place right now for next fall. And it's like with the squash, it's not an easy process. It's not something that I can snap my fingers and boom, we have, you know, a silo full of traditional corn. It's something that we're really going to have to consciously make that motion to say we have to invest more in agriculture. And it's happening. There's a shift happening. And I think being able to see so many tribal farms or growing efforts not only succeed, but have their communities support them in a way where they're able to thrive, regardless of what it is they're growing. You know, if you were able to produce, you did an awesome job, because it's intimidating to try and say, I'm going to grow a garden. And if you live in an apartment or an urban area, to say, I'm still going to do it. And so it has started this forward motion. And I think the more, as a chef and as a supporter of agriculture and really trying to be proactive towards our traditional food systems, we saw the time is now to really continue that momentum and to really push it farther ahead and say that this is achievable. We can do this and we don't need a lot of resources. And if you aren't, like I said before, if you're not a hunter or you're not a forager or a cultivator, everybody eats. Everybody needs to cook. At some point you know, these things you will find where you connect.
So on a related note, do you see more non-native consumers making a shift toward native foods and cooking because of the pandemic?
With indigenous foods, one of the biggest obstacles is accessibility for us as well. And the more we support those producers, the growers, the farmers, the foragers, the more of that pure product we'll be able to have, not only for indigenous communities, for our families, but for the greater community to really build up a support system to make sure that those ingredients will be appreciated and preserved for the long term.
So that leads right into my next question. Thank you for that beautiful segue. For those of us that want to learn more, where can our listeners acquire native foods? And also, how can they support First Nations farmers and food producers?
So I do have a partnership with the Intertribal Agriculture Council, and I work as part of the Honoring Our Farmers, Foragers, Growers, and Producers tour was under the American Indian Foods Program to really put a face and a name to that product. To know that that can of salmon is actually from Susie. Like, she made that happen. And she's this, you know, little lady out there doing what's good and being a steward of the water. So they have a whole producers list, the American Indian Foods page on Facebook, their website. And you can contact those producers directly. I believe most of them, some of them are seasonal production, but you can order. And I know I work specifically with Zebu Mijuwang Farms in Michigan, who is known for maple sugar, maple syrup, maple candy, wild rice. And I think that the more that we're able to support them by economically, you know, purchasing their product, the more that they're able to continue, you know, doing that or expand on what is available. So those are great resources. You can always, you know, contact farms specifically. Part of the reason I took that tour was because Sakari Farms and my friends in Alaska in Bend, Oregon suffered wildfires and it took out some of her crops. And they also had two significant hailstorms, which took out all of her ancestral squash seedlings. So we went out there to bring her fresh seed, you know, to bring her new seed to have for next year's grow. And so sometimes it's just, you know, contacting those farms and knowing that each one of them has a story like that, where you have to overcome. And you know, I love what you do, Springer. I love what you do, Zebu Mijuwang. What can I do to help? And, you know, Zebu is a nonprofit, Spring is a for-profit, independently owned farm. And so it's just kind of where you would want to help support with those resources and what their individual mission is. But there are directories like that. I know Twisted Sister podcast had a directory that she put out of native restaurants and some producers and stuff. So there are those resources out there to see. And you can always reach out and send a message to American Indian Foods and say, hey, I saw this. How can I get in touch with that? And I think when it comes to production, we want to get that information out there. Like, we want to get those products out and we want to support the work that they're doing. So, you know, feel free to reach out, send an email to any of them on those lists. And I mean, speaking from experience, they're really good about sharing that.
I want to thank our guest, Elena Terry, for joining us for this episode of Food End, the official podcast of the Gastronomy Program at Boston University. Signing off, I'm your host, Amanda Ballager.
Connect with new friends and get updates on new events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.